Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
In an act of blatant political partisanship, a rogue district attorney in Travis County, Texas, named Ronnie Earle, charged me with one count of criminal conspiracy, a reckless charge wholly unsupported by the facts.
Tom DeLay indicted yesterday. It was a blow to a hard-edged political career, one pocked with intrigue and ethics questions, and it is another problem for a Republican Party in no small turmoil today. Charged with conspiring to violate election laws in Texas, the Republican power player was forced to step aside Wednesday as majority leader in the House. DeLay was furious. Travis County, Texas DA Ronnie Earle stood tough.
Corporate contributions to political campaigns are illegal in Texas. The law makes such contributions a felony. My job is to prosecute felons.
DeLay fired back.
This is one of the weakest, most baseless indictments in American history. It's a sham, and Mr. Earle knows it.
The DeLay indictment is the latest in a series of Republican Party migraines. Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist is in the midst of an insider trading investigation. President Bush is making amends for the Katrina response. Fixer Jack Abramoff is indicted. Karl Rove has the Valerie Plame investigation swirling at his feet. GOP infighting over its own big spending is white hot. And polls show the Republican-led Congress with its lowest approval rating in 8 years. This hour on Point, the DeLay indictment and the Republican Party's tough season. You can join the conversation. Does this look to you like partisanship or overdue justice for Tom DeLay? And what is the moment emerging here for the suddenly troubled GOP? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is R.G. Ratcliffe, political reporter for the Houston Chronicle. He's been following the twists and turns of the Tom DeLay story. R.G., thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Tom DeLay says the weakest, most baseless indictment in American history. How does this indictment stand up?
Well, it's actually going to be an interesting court case because what you have is a situation that has been very common in federal elections in recent years where campaigns that have corporate money need to exchange that to money, what's called hard money, money that by individuals that can be used to pay for political ads and things that a candidate needs. Most of the hard, soft money issues were done away with the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform, which took effect right after the election that's at issue here.
But that's federal money, and we're talking here about state Texas law.
Right. And what happened was Tom DeLay's operatives in Texas tried to apply federal campaign standards to Texas law. And there's a lot of the investigation has centered on what you can and cannot spend corporate money on in Texas. But the one thing is very clear you cannot do is you cannot give corporate money to candidates. And what this indictment alleges is that Tom DeLay's operatives, with his tacit approval and knowledge, developed a scheme to take $190,000 in corporate money and convert it to hard money for candidates for the Texas House by running it through the Republican National Committee.
We're talking the 2002 elections here.
2002.
They were critical because if they could gain control in Texas, they could redistrict, and that meant also more Republican seats in the U.S. Congress.
Right. The Tom DeLay redistricting effort that occurred after the 2002 elections shifted the majority of the Texas congressional delegation from Democrat to Republican. It gave the Republicans six more seats in Congress. It also, of course, enhanced Tom DeLay's power within the House because that's six more votes for him as majority leader in the Republican caucus.
So this was a big deal, and a lot of money was put into it, $1.9 million in corporate funds. raised overall. And after the election, the head of the Texas Association of Business, Bill Hammond, said, "We blew the doors off on corporate fundraising." Is there any question, you're talking about the ambiguities, but under Texas law, is there any question that it was illegal to raise the corporate money in Texas, send it to Washington, and turn around and bring it back to Texas to use?
Well, that's going to be the heart of Tom DeLay's defense. There are some things that Tom DeLay's committee did, such as buying phone banks to test issues for candidates, that they claim was an administrative expense allowable under law. Clearly, a Texas PAC could raise corporate money and give it to the Republican National Committee. And clearly, the Republican National Committee can take individual hard money and give it to candidates in Texas. What the indictment alleges is that Jim Ellis, who is the director of Tom DeLay's Americans for a Republican Majority, gave the Republican National Committee a list of candidates that they wanted to have the corporate money traded for hard money, and that's where the indictments essentially allege money laundering.
Which would essentially be a money laundering operation in political terms here. Now, Tom DeLay says Ronnie Earl, the DA in Travis County, is engaged in blatant partisanship. He was a former Democratic member of the Texas House of Representatives, been DA for a long time now. He's gone after 15 elected officials in his career, but 12 of them were Democrats. Is it fair to look at this as a political partisanship when so many of his targets have been in the other party?
I think Ronnie acts in a way that's aside from partisan politics. He has this very strong sense of moral justice. In some of these other cases he's talked about, there are crimes and there are sins. And Ronnie Earl really believes that, I think, that money is a problem in American politics. And the question is whether or not he's pushing the envelope of the Texas money laundering and campaign finance laws, because he believes that Tom DeLay and Bill Hammond and everyone else so pushed the envelope of what you could use corporate money for and injected a whole new style of financing into Texas elections that justice can be served just by indicting Tom DeLay.
And RG, what do you think, is Tom DeLay going to focus his defense on saying it actually wasn't wrong, or it happened but I wasn't actually involved?
Actually, it'll be a little bit of both. DeLay has consistently taken the position that, yes, he helped set up TrimPAC, yes, he was on the board of directors, but that he was not involved in the day-to-day operations, and that this transaction of money involved day-to-day operations carried out by the director, John Colleandro, and Jim Ellis. That's one defense. The other defense is that there was nothing illegal in the Republican National Committee swapping out money for candidates. And partly the defense there will be that it was just so routine at the time that it was done almost every day in almost every state of the union.
RG, what's the calendar look like here? When does this go to trial?
Well, Mr. DeLay's attorney, Dick DeGuerin, said yesterday that he wants it to come to trial before the end of the year, that he wants a swift trial. There's nothing on the schedule as of today. And the question there is just, is Mr. DeGuerin really wanting a quick trial, or is just that what all attorneys say to the reporters when their client gets indicted and they want to hold out that they're innocent? The case could potentially come to trial by the end of the year. It would not give them much time to challenge any of the legal issues, and the facts are not in dispute. It'd be sort of a roll of a dice for Mr. DeLay to push the trial ahead that fast.
Big-time consequences of a trial coming up in Texas. R.G. Ratcliffe with the Houston Chronicle, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
R.G. Ratcliffe in Austin, Texas. Joining me now from New York is Josh Micah Marshall. He's editor of the blog TalkingPointsMemo.com, contributing writer for the Washington Monthly, columnist for the newspaper The Hill, which covers Congress. Josh Marshall, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You've paid a lot of attention to Tom DeLay. Is this the whole show we're talking about here, or how big is the surround of other issues that have floated around this power broker?
Well, this is the thing. The issue down in Texas with this grand jury that, you know, it's been sitting for some time now, this was supposed to be the lesser problem for Tom DeLay. This was the one that he was supposed to get out of, basically, that wasn't supposed to be a problem. the big iceberg on the horizon is the sprawling Abramoff investigation in Washington, which is in the out of the U.S. Justice Department. Again, that's the big problem that everybody's looking forward to. So the fact that again it was and, you know, I've talked to, this really did come as, this wasn't just a surprise to people around the country or to some newspaper editors. Pretty high up at the staff level, people on Republican staffers on Capitol Hill did not know this was coming until the night before, that it was even a possibility. So it's been a shock. It's a very big deal. I think it's quite questionable that politically he can ever take the majority leadership back again. But this is not the whole deal. This isn't even really the big deal in terms of the legal problems that Tom DeLay has coming down the pike.
We'll talk about those. Stepping into his shoes, at least temporarily, though it's at least a year, we're being told, is Roy Blunt of Missouri. Is he the squeaky clean alternative?
No, he's definitely not. I mean, I'm sure you will be hearing from Democrats. There is a long list of bill particulars about Roy Blunt. A lot of stuff that is similar to charges against DeLay. The key is that Roy Blunt is the heir apparent within the Tom DeLay political machine in Washington, D.C. It is very closely tied to K Street. It is built around, there used to be this phrase, honest graft, and I'm not sure that's not sure that's exactly the right word to use with Tom DeLay, but this system is built on very close relationships with lobbyists on Capitol Hill, with K Street, and it's a sort of an institutionalized corruption, I think, is really the best way to look at it.
That's a charge. Joshua Michael Marshall, hold the thought. We'll come back to it, if you'd be so kind. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking about the indictment of Tom DeLay, and you can join the conversation. Have you followed the rise of the hammer? Is this the fall? Does this look like rough justice or overdue justice? 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the indictment of Tom DeLay and its meaning for the Republican Party. You can join the conversation. What's the bigger picture here for Republican leadership, for Republican credibility? Tom DeLay calls it blatant political partisanship. How do you see it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. A lot of GOP defense of Tom DeLay in Washington yesterday. Let's listen to some of that, starting here with Speaker of the House, Republican Dennis Hastert.
Our hearts and prayers go out for him. We do have a system. I hope everybody understands that you are innocent until you're proven guilty, and he will fight this, and we give him our utmost support.
Not the warmest embrace from the White House, but definitely a defense of Tom DeLay. Here's White House Press Secretary Scott McClellan on the official White House response to yesterday's indictment.
Congressman DeLay is a good ally, a leader who we have worked closely with to get things done for the American people.
And finally, Missouri Congressman Roy Blunt, former House, this is the whip stepping into the interim majority leader's position as Tom DeLay is indicted. Here's what he had to say about the indictment.
I think largely because of his effectiveness as a leader, he became a target. We all believe that he'll return once this indictment is out of the way.
Roy Blunt yesterday, so what do you see going on here with Tom DeLay on Capitol Hill with the Republican Party, and what about the Democrats' response? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from New York by Joshua Micah Marshall, editor of the blog TalkingPointsMemo.com and a contributor to the Washington Monthly. We're joined now as well from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania by Lou DeBose, co-author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. He's former editor of the Texas Observer. Lou DeBose, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
So, the Tom DeLay moment here. Do you think he thought he was going to duck this bullet, dodge it?
I think he had a healthy fear and respect of Ronnie Earle, but and there's a long paper trail. There are you know, the reporters found 2 years ago of $25,000 corporate contributions sent directly to Tom DeLay, two of them specifically that I can think of, which is illegal in Texas, if indeed it was spent on election campaigns. And a civil suit, a judge has ruled that it was. A civil suit against Trimpac, a state judge has ruled that it was illegal. But Ronnie Earle is, as RG said, a highly moral prosecutor, moralistic prosecutor, who will find a way, has found a way to take that evidence and not try it under the penal, under the election code, which would mean Tom DeLay would have to be tried in his home district where there's a Republican DA who would never indict him.
Yep.
But to use the penal code, which can be tried in Austin, and that's where the creative use of the law has put Tom DeLay under the hammer.
Tom DeLay is known, as you write right in the title of your book, as the hammer in Washington, really straight up honestly feared for many years, respected by Republicans for what he could drive through, but also feared even by many of his supporters. How brave or, I don't know, risky a step is this for Ronnie Earle? What's the situation back home?
Well, Ronnie Earle is an independently elected Democratic prosecutor in his 26th year. As RG said, he's prosecuted 13 Democrats and three Republicans, but, you know, mostly because there were no Republicans to prosecute when he started out in Texas. You know, he brought his last big conviction was a Speaker of the House whom he retired, an ethically challenged Speaker of the House. And he was a Democrat. He lost with Kay Bailey Hutchison. He backed away. He folded at the bar when the judge handed down an adverse ruling. But he also lost with Jim Mannix, sitting Democratic Attorney General. So he's not afraid to go after these guys. And this is the end of his career. I mean, this is his career cap. And it's hard
to imagine. You're talking Ronnie Earle's career.
It might be the end of Tom DeLay's career.
This is a swan song. Mm.
Right. Unclear antecedent there. But this is it. This is his swan song. He avoided retirement. He skipped it. He held off, deferred his retirement, and retiring to the ranch to pursue this investigation to where it leads. I don't think he's afraid of Tom DeLay or has any political consequences. You know, the guy's got a small staff. The Republicans and the legislature are threatening to cut his funding, and he's soldiering on. I mean, they've been threatening this for 2 years now since he got deeply involved. 3 years since he got deeply involved in this, and yet Ronnie Earle soldiers on. So I don't think that the hammer strikes any fear in the heart of Ronnie Earle.
So the torpedo versus the hammer here, he just keeps moving straight ahead. Josh Michael Marshall, you were talking before the break about this sort of penumbra around this case of other issues, which you say may even be bigger issues. Democrats are making a lot of noise about those right now, but I'm not sure I understand exactly what they are. Fill in that picture, what you call the machine, the K Street system.
Well, when the Republicans took power after 1994, they had what they called the K Street Project, and what that was basically building a political machine on Capitol Hill that pulled in the money and really took control of K Street, by which people mean the swarm of lobbyists in Washington. When we were talking about Blunt a little earlier, he's a deputy in that political machine. And what I mean a political machine the way that Mayor Daley, the original Mayor Daley, mm-hmm. had in Chicago, Boss Tweed up in New York in the previous century. Political machines, you know, it's whether you consider them inherently corrupt or not is sort of, you know, in the eye of the beholder. But they inevitably are always right up against the edge. And the Abramoff investigation, you have one key player, Jack Abramoff, a major GOP lobbyist, who is really on the brink of pulling down that whole machine. There's a big Justice Department investigation looking into him. The investigation has touched on DeLay. It's touched on a number of people on Capitol Hill. It has targets in the White House now. So that investigation is much more broad-ranging. And if it has the effect that some Republicans fear and many Democrats can't wait to see, it could really deal quite a blow to that whole political machine, not just Tom DeLay.
And that one is getting stranger and stranger. We saw charges yesterday against three men in a 2001 gangland-style slaying of a Florida businessman on a street in Miami, gunned down in his car after selling a casino cruise line to a group that included Jack Abramoff, the Washington lobbyist. Is all this in the same big stew, or is that a different thing entirely, Josh?
It's not as different as a lot of Republicans on Capitol Hill would like it to be. This is Jack Abramoff got heavy into lobbying on behalf of gambling interests. That led him to be the co-owner of this casino boat company in Florida called Sun Cruise. And the person they sort of leveraged the company away from was murdered in 2001. And now Abramoff's, this hasn't been made quite explicit yet in the indictments, but Abramoff's co-owner of that company is basically the one who is accused of hiring mobsters, actually from the Gotti family, to kill this their sort of erstwhile business partner. So yes, it really is all combined. Obviously, no one is connecting Tom DeLay or sitting members of Congress directly to this murder, but it is all one part of one big stew, and no politician likes to be referenced in the same paragraph as gangland-style murder.
Stranger and stranger. Lou DeBose, we want to try and have the whole picture in front of us here. I mean, the wheels of justice will turn now with Tom DeLay, and we'll see what happens on this charge. Josh Michael Marshall paints a bigger picture, a really big mural of a whole system that he sees DeLay sitting in the midst, or maybe the middle of. You've watched Tom DeLay for a long time. Does that make sense to you, or does that sound like even beyond his ethical boundaries?
No, it makes absolute sense. I mean, let's bear in mind what Jack Abramoff did was he sold Tom DeLay's name and influence. He was a member of DeLay's kitchen cabinet, a longtime friend. He went to these Indian tribes, not dirt poor Indian tribes living in the American West on reservations, but
casino tribes, yeah,
rich Indian tribes, and he went to them and promised to use the federal government to essentially, he was selling protection for their turf, in mob terms. The guy's a RICO suit about to happen every day. Jack Abramoff, closely associated with DeLay. Then they went to these tribes. They billed them $82 million for probably what was about $25 million worth of lobbying, staggering amounts of money. Then he began directing, this is a sort of outreach piece of the K Street project. Then he began directing these tribes to make contributions. I sat in the Cachado in Indian Reservation in Louisiana and looked at $300,000 in checks written in one day. $10,000 went to Tom DeLay's pact. $20,000 went to another Tom DeLay pact. You know, $40,000 went to the Republicans in the Senate. So they shook these Indians down, not only lining their own pockets, but lining the pockets of big Republican interests, advocacy groups, and campaign funds. $500,000 went to from Indian money went to the Republican National Governor's Conference in 2002.
So there's a big picture here that goes beyond Ronnie Earle. Josh Marshall, I know we just have you for another second here. This is way beyond the Travis County DA's writ. Is all this likely to be relevant, or is this just is something unraveling here, I guess, is the question.
Well, certainly seems so. There was these indictments you mentioned for the murder in 2001 that came down just a few days ago. This one yesterday. Even things that really can't be directly related seem to be coming together. There does seem to be some very bad karma hovering over Capitol Hill right now for the Republicans. I do think the fact that the Earle investigation in Travis County is one relatively contained part of this. But if you look at the larger Abramoff investigation, which pulls in DeLay, that definitely is picking up momentum. You had an arrest of a White House official about 10 days ago. So this is really, it is picking up momentum. They are coming together. There may even be some reason, which I don't understand at this point, why that investigation is actually in some way connected, directly connected, and the timing is connected to what Ronnie Earle's doing. But the whole pace of events definitely is picking up. There's no question about it.
Curiouser and curiouser, and not a fun moment for the GOP. Joshua Michael Marshall, editor of TalkingPointsMemo.com. Great having you with us. Thanks for joining
us.
I want to turn now to Dallas, if I may, and to William McKenzie. He's a columnist for the Dallas Morning News and has been a frequent guest of ours. Bill McKenzie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
So here's the delay indictment. You're a conservative columnist there in Dallas, looking out across your state and at the Republican Party nationally. Is this a how do you look at this moment? Is it a cleansing moment? Is it a bad thing? Is it a good thing? In what terms for the GOP?
Well, it may be both. It's certainly a bad moment for some of the reasons your previous guests were citing. The Republicans have a number of ethics issues they're having to deal with. Nobody likes to have to confront those type. No party likes to have that on their watch. The cleansing part of it, though, is up to Republicans. You know, they have a moment here to perhaps change part of the equation in Washington, and they perhaps started to do that yesterday by naming Roy Blunt to be the temporary successor to Tom DeLay. By all reputation, Mr. Blunt is a more conciliatory leader, more like Speaker Denny Hastert. If I were in the Bush's advising circle, I actually would think that would be a good thing. Maybe you can move something like immigration. Maybe you can move some of these other pieces of legislation that have been log-jammed.
With some new leadership there, though, Tom DeLay has in the past been a very effective leader. You're a conservative observer in Texas. When Tom DeLay calls this blatant political partisanship, you're also a pretty level-headed guy. How do you see it, William McKenzie? Do you see this as blatant partisanship or not?
No, I don't. I mean, there are issues that exist out of Republican and Democratic circles, if you will. I mean, the issue is whether or not the money that was raised in Texas from these corporations went to Washington and came back to the state races. No one is disputing, best I can tell and best all I can hear, nobody's disputing that happened. The question is whether that will constitute breaking state laws. And I think that the two DeLay associates, their lawyer is going to have to be really good in court, because as a layperson looking at this, it doesn't look good. DeLay is in a different situation. It seems to me the question then will be, is the old Howard Baker line, sorry to use it again, but what did he know and when did he know it?
Mm-hmm.
There's a case to be made that members of Congress are very busy. They have organizations that operate outside of themselves, and they have some relationship to. Sometimes
so can he distance himself from the particulars of the charge here? I want to begin to bring our callers in, if I may. John's calling from Amherst, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi, folks. Yeah, as you know, Tom, I am a conservative. I've called. Thank you very much once again for taking my call.
Good to have you.
Thank you very much. I do believe that this is completely politically motivated. Whenever I hear anything about corporate campaign funds, and as I told your screener, I hearken back to 1996 with Bernie Schwartz of Loral Aerospace, who was one of the largest contributors. Now, if I may make my point here. He personally enriched Bill Clinton to the tune of $100,000 for his own personal campaign, and then Bill Clinton waived trade laws in order to sell him sophisticated guidance systems to the communist Chinese.
So you're throwing a stone in another direction. We hear that, but how does that clear Tom DeLay? Does that mean things are just A-OK now?
Well, you know what? The whole genesis of this was because Houston, or Texas, I mean, had an inordinate amount of Democrat congressional districts in a state that generally went 60-40 Republican.
So he's a good man, and you're making the witch hunt charge here.
Well, the thing is, Tom Emmer is portrayed as this evil, evil man, but he is probably one of the most philanthropic of all the congressmen of the 435 that sit in that body by virtue of his work with the foster children. And Tom, he didn't enrich himself one iota with this money.
The many kinds of currency in the world, but we take your point, John. Thank you for calling. Lou DeBose, he's saintly.
Hardly saintly. I think John makes a fair point. Republicans were underrepresented in the Texas legislature because the Texans held the Democrats held control of the legislature, and that's the way of the world. You know, you got to win these things fair, and you can't say you cannot say because Bill Clinton took $100,000, Tom DeLay had the right to come in and raise $1.9 million in corporate money. Half of it in corporate money, not declare it. Now, he didn't do it himself, but he did lot of the fundraising. He's going to have a hard time distancing himself from the fundraising, and I think Bill McKenzie's right. The two guys who initially who are doing the work on the ground, Caliendo and Ellis, are in a world of trouble because they were running the show. DeLay can claim that he was a little bit distanced from it.
But the ripples go wide here. Lou DeBose, William McKenzie, please stand by. Karen Tumulty with Time will join us in just a moment. Listeners, you can join us as well. Tom DeLay calls it blatant political partisanship. Who would know better than him? And can you imagine the pressures on Ronnie Earle, the DA down in Texas? What is the moment that's emerging here for the GOP? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services in Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the indictment of Tom DeLay and its meaning for the Republican Party. You can join us. What do you see going on here? What's the big picture emerging? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined by Lou DeBose, co-author of The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Money, and the Rise of the Republican Congress. He's former editor of the Texas Observer. We're joined from Dallas, Texas, by William McKenzie, columnist there for the Dallas Morning News. And right now, from Washington, by Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for Time magazine. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So draw the lens way back for us here, Karen. This is a darn difficult moment for the Republican Party. I mean, all the way from ethics charges to their own infighting about big spending and the performance after Katrina. So is this a real rock the boat moment, or do they carry through here?
Oh, it is a rock the boat doesn't even begin to this sort of, you know, is Hurricane Katrina for the Republican Party. And, you know, you saw it in the incredibly intense behind-the-scenes fight that went on yesterday over who should be replacing Tom DeLay in the interim.
And what was at stake? What were the battle lines there?
Well, here's the issue. Tom DeLay did not want to see his number two guy, Roy Blunt, elevated, because if Blunt took a step up, everybody beneath him would take a step up, and
To come back.
If and when Tom DeLay returned, you know, they probably wouldn't want to step down again.
Right.
So he tried to engineer it so that a caretaker, the Rules Committee chairman, David Dreyer, you know, mm-hmm. played well on TV, loyal to the leadership, would come in as a caretaker. Well, the fact that the House Republican Conference, the Republican members, just erupted at this idea. And Blunt himself said, you know, I really should be taking over in the interim, at least.
And they erupted because they didn't like Dreyer, or they wanted Tom DeLay out without room to return.
Well, they found different reasons to erupt, but among other things, some of them thought Dreyer was too liberal. You know, others thought Tom DeLay shouldn't even have to step down, even though the House rules stipulate this. But the fact is that this machine that used to work so smoothly, because Tom DeLay was there to make it work,
the Hammer
just absolutely fell apart. And don't forget, there's another drama playing out on the other side of the Capitol, because we've seen questions raised this week over Bill Frist and some stock transactions.
His sale in June of this HCA hospital chain stock founded by his family, just before it tanked.
Exactly. And by the way, we may have, as early as tomorrow, another Supreme Court nomination to come into this dysfunctional family. So it is sheer chaos right now.
And what about the kind of ideological white heat we hear around spending? I mean, the GOP has led the Congress, they've had the White House, and the spending is what everybody sees now. And now there seems a kind of, self-laceration going on big time among some Republicans.
Absolutely. And what you see are, you know, the sort of younger more ideologically edged members saying, you know, we need to come up with cutting spending as a cause. And then you hear Tom DeLay, who himself was among the younger ideologically edged members a decade ago who overthrew their leadership, is standing up and defending the status quo. Well, you know, we all feel like we've seen this play before.
William McKenzie, Newt Gingrich used to talk about the arrogance of power. I mean, it is hard for any party to hold power for a long time and not be touched by that. Do you see that now playing out with the GOP, or is this a moment's rough patch?
Sure. I think I'll introduce another element of this conversation.
Yes, please.
I think if you scratch below the surface of very much, you will find a lot of rank-and-file Republicans who privately may see this as a good thing, an opportunity. I ran into a well-connected conservative in Dallas yesterday who really surprised me when I told this individual about DeLay's indictment.
Yeah.
The first response was, you know, these guys have had power for too long, and this may be the comeuppance they need.
But they surely don't want to lose Republican control on Capitol Hill.
And nobody was saying that. It's the way in which they are exercising power. And I will also say that while George Bush has needed Tom DeLay on Capitol Hill, I'd bet some money that in his heart of hearts, while all of this is swirling around and he doesn't want it, I wouldn't be surprised if George Bush doesn't see that, you know, working with Roy Blunt and some of these more conciliatory leaders on Capitol Hill may be a better thing. He would never say it publicly. He would never go out and do it. But, you know, just his track record, that really, Tom DeLay really wasn't, never has been exactly, he's been an ally of necessity.
Yeah, not George Bush's cup of tea. Karen Tumulty, you've got 30 votes separating the Republican majority from the Democratic minority in the House. Is there a path by which Republicans could have what William McKenzie calls a comeuppance here and still come out winners? Can they have a kind of internal house cleaning? Are they in such a powerful position that they could, you know, take that hit and still come out on top?
That is a very, very good question, and especially if this whole scandal is dragging out into next spring. Right now, the Republicans, the House is so gerrymandered that the whole system is pretty well, you know, makes it hard for the Democrats to make any sort of sizable gains. But we're in the middle of candidate recruitment season, and a lot of the kind of strong potential Democratic challengers out there are going to see this environment and feel like maybe this is the time they're going to take their shot at trying to unseat a Republican incumbent.
Let's take a call here. Andrew's calling from Washington. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. I'd like to respond to the Republican defense of Tom DeLay that I've sort of been hearing for a while.
Yep.
In that they keep sort of saying that, well, they're just coming after him because he's so effective. And to me, that sounds like if I was, you know, playing cards with somebody and I caught him cheating, and they'd say, well, you're just getting mad because I won.
But now, I mean, we heard that in the official statement yesterday, but now we're hearing, Andrew, from, for example, Bill McKenzie and his Republican friends in Dallas saying, well, maybe, you know, let's not defend so hard here. Maybe if he goes, it's all right.
Well, I hope there are more people in the party that are feeling that way.
Because you see him as straight up deserving of the exit, and we've got it. Andrew, thanks for that. Lou DeBose, what do you imagine Tom DeLay is thinking as he watches all this? You followed him very closely. He was fighting, as Karen says, even to yesterday, to put a guy in his shoes temporarily that he could come back and knock out of the box again. Do you imagine a surrender at any, some level on DeLay's part?
At a certain point, I think so, Tom. I think right now he's thinking that he and Dick DeGaron, one of the best trial attorneys, criminal defense attorneys in Texas, are going to beat the charges. The charges are sort of a secondary thing because he's subject to the criminal discovery process. He's a bad story in the Washington Post every other day. But I think he's thinking how he stays out of jail. And I think at the moment he's probably thinking, because Tom DeLay is resilient and is one of the most pugnacious members of Congress. Literally, he's taken a few swings at members, grabbed Dick Armey by the tie and threatened to choke him when Armey was majority leader in a hall in Congress. You know, he's a fighter.
That's aggressive.
So, So that's aggressive, and he's an aggressive, pugilistic legislator and leader. I think he'll resolve to fight this out, but I think ultimately the leadership comes to him and says it's time to say goodnight, Tom.
John is calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
How are you?
We're good. What do you think?
I think basically it's a pox on both houses. I think that the financing done by Democrats and Republicans is obscene.
Josh, I think we got the pox on both houses, and it sounds like you're in a tsunami there or a windstorm with the cell. But thanks for that. Karen Tumbley, how about that? We've heard that from a couple of callers. Everybody plays dirty. Is there a difference in extreme, in extent now?
Well, what the difference is that when voters get disgusted, they tend to punish the people in power.
That's the only difference, just where voters are looking at the moment? Is there a qualitative difference?
Well, Republicans really have centralized power in Congress in a way that the Democrats were unable to do. They have, Tom DeLay in particular, and this is, by the way, the story of their effectiveness. Tom DeLay built a network with the lobbying community on K Street and other Republican interest groups. Unlike, it was a more seamless network than anything the Democrats were ever able to do. The Republicans changed the rules of the House so that power was far more centralized in the House Republican leadership. So, again, to the degree people are, to the degree this really has resonance in America, and I'm not sure at this point how far it goes, I do think that voters are going to, punish the people in power. But don't ever put it past the Democrats to completely, mess up what should be a good storyline for them.
Yeah. But beyond, and we'll look at that, but beyond the ballot box, what about just on the legal front? Josh Micah Marshall was suggesting earlier that there's a kind of, the whole K Street system is threatening now to implode, that we could have a welter of charges and indictments, a kind of, Republican Götterdämmerung here, Teapot Dome scandal. Do you see the potential for that, or is it more contained?
I do think that the Jack Abramoff investigation, which last I checked had something like 16 FBI agents assigned to it full-time.
Wow.
That does, in fact, have the potential to end up really, splashing all over almost everybody.
Linda's calling from Iowa City. Hi, Linda, you're on the air.
Hi. It seems to me that the central core of this issue is the fact that that the Republican Party has become controlled by what Richard Hofstadter, the American intellectual historian, called true believers. And for them, the issue is because they are right and good, anything they do is right and good, and so the rules don't apply to them. So they can do pretty much anything they want. They end up believing that the end justifies the means simply because their sense of themselves as being right is so strong.
But Linda, has the means taken over here? Because as you heard earlier from William McKinsey, there are a lot of, let's say, fiscally conservative Republicans who are very uneasy with their own party right now.
But the problem is that when you have a party controlled by true believers, everybody else falls in line. They are afraid, and I don't mean Abramoff's buddies are going to come and knock him off, but they are afraid of the power, and they get swept into it. So even regular conservatives who would worry about fiscal issues don't. Even so-called moderates like Susan Collins
in Maine,
end up following along behind because the power of the true believers is to sweep all before them.
For a while, for a time, but maybe there's an end to that. Linda, thank you for your call. Ludabose, Tom DeLay, a true believer or something else?
Something else and a true believer. I mean, Tom DeLay was a fiscal conservative. He's not a conservative anymore. I think Tom DeLay is a true believer in power now. And he, bear in mind that he he appointed essentially Denny Hastert speaker, and he named his, and both of these men formerly worked for him as deputy whips, and he made Roy Blunt whip when Newt Gingrich was collapsing, and then Bob Livingston in 98, when Bob Livingston's sexual peccadilloes were revealed by Larry Flint, Denny Hastert and said, "You're the one." And according to Delay, in Delay's own words, Denny turned white as a sheet.
Yeah.
So you know, I think that there's a certain point at which he understood that they could make this House run as a parliamentary system, and it was all about control and power and harnessing domesticating K Street in a way no one else has ever done, making the lobby pay essentially tribute money to the Republican Party, insisting even that they not contribute to Democrats, calling them in and saying, you've given money to Democrats, that's over, we're in charge, if you want to play in our revolution, you got to pay. So I think he started out as a true believer, a real conservative. But I think his real belief now is we hold power and we are the permanent majority.
William McKenzie, I want to be sure we have your view completely here. How are you listening to all this? You look at this from a conservative angle. There's clearly some ugly stuff swirling around here. Do you agree with this kind of fundamental corruption by power view of the big case here or not? Can you imagine the GOP itself splitting over these issues?
Well, I don't know if they will split. I would agree with Lou. I think that Tom DeLay's main belief at this point is about power, and there are a number who would be in his camp, you know, the higher up the leadership structure you go. But as to the caller from Iowa City, I would say some of those true believers really still believe in controlling deficits. Some of those people really believe in Newt's ideal of fighting corruption, and maybe that's what the individual I was referring to here in Dallas is reflecting. Once you get below the surface on Capitol Hill or the talk show circuit.
Exactly.
There may be some rank and file people who are saying, you know, we don't want to spend ourselves into oblivion and we got to do something about it.
But
and
where does that energy go, Bill, when you've got these examples up in the leadership that look like such powerful counter examples?
Right. I'm not here to say that the rank and file is going to rise up tomorrow and cleanse out the Republican Party. But the more this plays out, I will be looking for are those voices, and voices, you know, on Main Street, but also voices in Capitol Hill. I mean, you see some people who've already been kind of countering the president on money for Katrina, and Jeb Hensarling, a congressman from Dallas, a real conservative. You have others like Zach Womp from Tennessee who've stood out against the deficit. I'm not arguing these people have the numbers, but it will be interesting to see the role they play going forward.
Karen Tumulty, we've just got a minute here. Will the Democrats make hay with this? Do the Republicans have a self-healing mechanism here? How do you see the cards falling?
Well, I have certainly, you know, I've never seen anybody, you know, any party when hit with something like this able to heal itself without going through a major purge first. So, and that purge may well be at the ballot box next year. I think the Democrats, though, do have to be very careful how they handle this, because, of course, Ronny Earle is immediately hit with charges of this just being nothing but a partisan witch hunt. And, by the way, I was surprised at how quiet they were yesterday when all this was unfolding.
The Democrats purposely were told that they were told to stand down, hold their fire, let Republicans swing in the wind, twist a little bit.
Absolutely, which was probably the smartest thing they could have done.
Nancy Pelosi guiding that. But do you see the Democrats ready with this raft of counter-candidates and their alternate view to sweep into the void here?
Well, certainly the Republicans have been disappointed in some of their Senate candidate recruitments in places like Florida and Nebraska, where they thought they were going to have big, strong contenders. They didn't get them. And I, you know, assume that the Democrats are now finding that they're getting more interest than they thought they would.
Well, it's quite a moment. Karen Tumulty at Time Magazine in Washington, William McKenzie with the Dallas Morning News in Dallas, and Lou DeBose, co-author of The Hammer. Grateful to each of you for being with us. It's just terrific having you. Thanks for your insights. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.